Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight I'll be speaking with Lee Rocker. Now, with and without the Stray Cats, he's been a solid part of rockabilly for the past 40 years and has a new album just out. We'll begin the program with Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Justin Bua, a critically acclaimed urban artist with a world-renowned, recognizable style. We'll hear about his podcast, Art Attack, with its 100th episode approaching.
Before we speak more about Art Attack, will you speak with our audience a bit about who you are? When did you begin your art career?
I started painting as a young kid in New York City, as a graffiti writer, actually. My mom and grandfather were both classical painters, so I was influenced by both cultures, the diametric opposition of street art and the classical world as well.
When you say on the street, is that the same as tagging?
No, I think there's a big distinction between just tagging, which is like getting your name up in lights, as we used to call it, going all city, so you would write your name in as many places as possible. But what I was much more attracted to was the allure of full value, full, rich, colorful paintings. The things that I like to study are always people.
Okay.
You know, I live next to a welfare hotel. There was two on my block, over 200 in my neighborhood.
Wow.
And I painted a lot of the people in my world, in my community, the marginalized and the people who were just outside of the norm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You are author of two books, and I'll get to that a little bit later, but I'm so curious. In your books, do you have pictures of those early paintings that you painted of people in those hotels?
Yeah, in my first book, The Beat of Urban Art, which is an acronym for my name, BUA, B-U-A,
okay.
I did a lot of those characters. Those characters kind of lived in my consciousness. They weren't necessarily real people in my book, but they were realistic interpretations of people that existed in my neighborhood.
Now, Justin, how do you describe your style of art?
I am an urban artist, for sure. I'm definitely a populist, and I definitely tend towards realism and figurative. So I don't really give it a name. I'm definitely not a street artist. I'm not a graffiti writer anymore. But at the same time, you know, I don't really subscribe to any movements that are going on today. I'm just a painter.
Okay. How would Lizzie describe your art today? Would she agree with you?
Yeah, Lizzie is my partner on the radio show, yes. Art Attack, and she's way more of an able, articulate dialectician than I am, so
yes.
She would probably say something where I would be like, yeah, that's what I'm talking about, what she said. I have to look up half the words she says, but she uses them in a very poignant way, and she's the real deal. She really, like myself, loves art history. She loves the culture. She loves art. And that's what we're doing with our podcast, is we're telling the world about art and sharing it freely. We definitely don't agree on everything, thus the back and forth banter. I mean, we do agree on a lot of stuff, but when we don't agree, it's a little bit like oil and water.
Okay. Now, we'll come back to that a little bit later here, because I'd like to talk a little bit more about the books that you've published, The Legends of Hip Hop and The Beat of Urban Art. Now, you've already shared with us a little bit about The Beat of Urban Art, but will you tell us a bit about these books and how you chose your subjects?
Well, you know, I realized that no one had ever painted the legends of hip-hop. There was photographs of all these icons, and back in the days, you know, when artists were court painters, and they painted the dukes and the earls and the kings and the popes, I figured, why not paint the people that were really important for my generation? Whether it was James Brown or Tupac or Jay-Z or Wu-Tang Clan, those are the people that were heroes that I grew up with, but there was no real paintings representing them and the essence of them, because a really good portrait is really capturing not just a likeness, but you're capturing the spirit and the essence of somebody.
It's amazing because you have a lot of substance to your paintings and the podcast. And someone like me is pretty challenged with things of art, whether
right.
from the Renaissance or today. I'm like a lot of people. I really don't know what people are talking about when they're talking about so many nuances that it's like, well, look, it's a can of Campbell's soup. I'll come back to Andy in a little bit, too. But you guys actually do a great job of getting across some things that I normally would not know what they're talking about in an art studio. So thank you for that.
Well, we make it digestible. I like to say that Art Attack is a podcast that is meant for the people, by the people, Lizzie and myself, of the people. Because,
yeah.
You know, the reason that we really did it, to be honest, is because we were listening to podcasts And we were listening to shows on art, and we didn't find anything that was substantial for us. It was either very hard to listen to, it was very boring, it was very repetitive.
Yes.
Or it was just lecturing in Oxford or Yale or something. But there wasn't anybody that was talking to your average consumer. You can be an art historian buff, or you could be somebody that doesn't really understand or go to museums, doesn't understand art or the culture. But you don't have to be an art snob to understand our podcast, because it's meant for everybody.
Yes. Justin, will you take just a moment to share with our audience where they can find more information about your podcast, Art Attack, and also where they can find more information on your art?
Art Attack is pretty much on every platform. It's on iTunes if you have an iPhone. It's on Stitcher. It's on Spotify. It's on multi platforms. And in terms of my artwork, you can find me on Instagram at Justin Bua, JustinBua, as well as JustinBua.com. And everybody calls me Bua because I'm a little bit mononymous in that way, where people get my first name wrong. They eventually call me Jason. Thank you for calling me Justin this entire time, by the way. Most people just call me Bua.
Okay. Now, I want to go back to the monotone explaining of art, because when I was growing up, the only people I remember speaking about art spoke in those monotone voices with noses in the air, you know, Thurston Howell III on Gilligan.
Exactly what I'm talking about.
That's
exactly
it. So it's a great thing. When I listen to the two of you speak about it with laughter and joy, it's a wonderful thing. Now, on the podcast, Art Attack, you and your co-host, Lizzie Dastin, will you tell us a bit about Lizzie? Because she really is something else as far as speaking about art. And again, your interactions go well together.
Yeah, Lizzie's just a great brain. She has a brain trust of art history knowledge and just knowledge in general. She's a professor at Santa Monica College in UCLA, and she has a master's, a PhD. She's very highly decorated. And her grandfather was actually Sidney Sheldon, interestingly enough, the writer, the guy who created Heart to Heart and I Dream of Jeannie. So she comes from a very literary family. She's quite a thinker and really takes art history and contextualizes it and makes it very metabolizable and digestible for everybody, because she, like myself, has such a spirit for it. She really loves it, and she's not just speaking about it and teaching about it because it's a job. She does it because it's a passion, and that's what Art Attack is. Art Attack is the culmination of passion from both of our worlds.
Right. Who are the people that you and Lizzie are trying to reach out to, and what do you hope that they will take away from the show as they listen?
You know, we're trying to reach out to anybody and everybody. You know, I think that much like the museum culture, it's a little highbrow ivory tower. So we want to make art history accessible for everybody. So it doesn't matter if you're a 65-year-old from Fifth Avenue and money-making Manhattan, or you're a teenager from Syria. You come from different worlds, but you can experience one thing, and that is the love of art. Even if I don't love an artist, or she doesn't love an artist, or there's things that are said that are just not the best ever about these artists that we're presenting to the world, there's still a passion and an understanding and a dissection of a painting or an artist or the narrative of their life story. So we go deep. We really go deep into experiencing the works of art. And that's what we try to do on a radio show, because that's really difficult, right?
Yes.
We're doing two things that are really outside of the norm. A of all, we don't have guests because we feel like it really just undermines our conversation. Because it's really about what we bring to the table from our unique perspectives.
Right.
And the other thing is, we're talking about a visual medium over radio. So we're only using audio. And the great thing is you can stop and go look it up, but sometimes people don't even do that, and they feel like they've experienced the painting by just listening. So it's a pretty epic show in that way.
Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Justin Bua. That 100th episode coming up, that'll be at artattackpodcast.com and justinbua.com. That's justinbua.com. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming.
Now, why Art Attack as the show's name?
I think we both felt like Art Attack obviously sounds like heart attack, but that's what it gives us. Art gives me a heart attack of pure emotion and bliss. I love art. I live art. I am art. I breathe art. I discover art. I talk about art. Art is omnipresent, flowing through my veins.
Wow.
And we both feel that way. We both feel that strongly. So it's an attack of art and history. It's great.
Justin, what could I learn about such artists as Pablo Picasso, Vincent van Gogh, Andy Warhol, and Claude Monet, just to name a few as I listen to Art Attack? Because one thing I learned about Andy Warhol, I'm going to keep picking on him, is that you found out that he had a nose job, making himself look more the way he wanted to present himself.
Well, Andy Warhol was amazing in a way where he was kind of the first iteration of what's going on in the art world today.
Okay.
He had a place called The Factory where he actually manufactured art with multiple artists. So he was kind of in the tradition of some of the earlier artists like Peter Paul Rubens, who had multiple people painting his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Warhol was very open about that. He had a place where multiple people were helping him fabricate and create his work. And he knew the importance of popularity. He knew the importance of going to these events and staying on the pulse of what was going on in pop culture. He knew to the point where he actually paid a body double on payroll. If he couldn't make the party in Soho, don't worry. His body double was at the Soho party, but Andy Warhol had to be uptown or in East Hampton. That was what was crazy. He knew the importance of socialization and popularity that played into his work.
So now I guess I'm not as confused about the can of Campbell's soup as I used to be, but still not completely clear about it.
Okay. Well, he was taking, you know, the mundanity of contemporary culture and saying, you know, is it soup or is it art? I mean, it's there.
This is amazing to me because, well, I guess, you know, growing up, you could see these things where you couldn't touch these people, but you see them in those shows where everybody's dressed really nice. They're in those parties that it's like, oh, God, I hope I never get invited to one of those because I wouldn't know what to do. And you find out that he's really branding himself. He's a little bit like Henry Ford, you know, with painting.
And that's an amazing point right there. He was the real first artist to brand himself. That's why he got the nose job. That's why he had the silver hair. The silver hair came way before he went gray. The silver hair was done in his 20s. His nose job was done when he was very young.
Wow.
He had a certain look and feel, and like I said, a body double on payroll to make sure that he presented himself to the world as a brand.
That's amazing. I'm actually starting to warm up to the guy as we talk. So
you know, me too. Like, I honestly couldn't stand Andy Warhol my whole life. And I saw him a couple times in New York growing up, just going to the parties with the graffiti writers and the B-boys and the downtown crowd. Because that downtown Fab Five Freddy crowd and Basquiat and Warhol, that all mixed. That all blended.
Well, I'm going to move on a little bit because I beat up Andy enough and now I like him more.
I'm either going to get you to hate people more or like him more. Lizzie's only going to make you like him more. My most powerful artist to me is always going to be Rembrandt. Even though he's so dark, there's something hauntingly beautiful about his portraits. I still feel today nobody has been a combination of a technical draftsman and a emotionally connected painter like Rembrandt has been. I mean, he's just a quintessential portrait artist. He's just freaking wonderful. But, you know, I'm also kind of a sucker for Norman Rockwell. When you see Rockwell in person, it almost brings you to tears. He was such a crazy good painter. He was a wonderful painter, and even though he was saccharine in terms of his Americana depictions and narratives and subjects, it's not saccharine to me because he just pulls it off because he's such a talented painter. There's just so many to name. Egon Schiele, Gustav Klimt, Anwar Daumier, Maxfield Parrish. The names go on and on. So I've got so many people that I love, but it's really what am I going through at the moment? And I've been going through a Rembrandt and Rockwell phase.
Okay.
You know, you go through your things. You're like, you know, I like kale salad this week, or you like whatever. I'm doing that. I'm doing the Rembrandt Rockwell right now. Next week it could be Degas. You know, I don't know.
Okay. What current artist are you most excited to speak about on Art Attack as people we should look out for? And others we should just know about.
I mean,
about.
We talk about contemporary artists as well. We talk about a lot of street artists. We just did one on Shepard Fairey, the street artist who did, of course, the Hope image of Obama, one of the most recognizable images in the history of the world. But then we did one on Picasso and Paul Cézanne. I mean, I love doing these episodes because I have to deep dive into their life stories, and I love their life stories. Like, what kind of life did Cezanne live when he was just really not in the mix of the Impressionists being accepted by anybody except a couple of people, and then moves away, creates a whole body of work, which is really the birth of contemporary art, of abstract art,
right.
Comes back, makes a huge splash in Paris, and becomes the father of Cubism in many ways. He had an incredible story, an incredible life, and he was also independently wealthy. Cezanne inherited a lot of money from his father, which is very different than most artists who are struggling, like Van Gogh. That's the quintessential idea of what we think an artist is, right? Somebody who's struggling, who's depressed, who's suicidal, he cuts his ear off.
Okay.
But then you have, on the other side, somebody like Cezanne, who was independently wealthy, and Balthus, who was independently wealthy as well. And Michelangelo, who was so wealthy, when he died, they found just treasures buried under his wood floors because he didn't even spend the money that he made from Pope Julius II.
Wow. It makes me really curious in speaking with you, because as you described those guys, I'm wondering, what will people discover about artists such as yourself and others in the future that they weren't speaking of like you are about these gentlemen now?
I think that they have to discover that real artists who are important are relevant for their time, because they're telling the story of their era. And I think that's why art is so important. I think every great artist has a great story that is reminiscent of their time and indicative of their time and era.
All right. Now, what is that special thing that attracts you to hip-hop and urban art as an art form?
You know, I've been in the culture. I was a professional b-boy for 12 years. I used to write graffiti. So to me, it was my culture that I grew up in and around. And I think it's really just important to tell the story. I was the first artist to ever paint the narratives of a DJ, the narrative of a b-boy, the narrative of an MC, of a graffiti writer. I took these archetypal characters and I put them into classical formats. You know, my compositions are not much different from Tiepolo or Correggio, you know? So I thought it was really important to paint the narratives of these people.
Will you explain for our audience what a b-boy is?
A b-boy is a break boy, somebody who dances on the floor.
Okay. I know many in our audience would not know that, and it's been a long time since I've done any break dancing myself. Well, you don't want to see it now.
Okay. You don't want to see me either. Don't worry about it.
All right. Well, Justin, I am really thankful that you joined us today, and I'd like to ask you, is there anything about the podcast that you would like to share with the audience that I haven't brought up?
I just think it's really important in a time where the NEA is cutting back funds for art and history. You know, the NEA cut from $150 million in 2017 to $29 million in 2018.
Wow.
Everybody's cutting. Nobody thinks art's important. I think art is one of the most important things that defines us as human beings. That's the difference between a human being and a human doing, is things like music and things like art. So what we're doing is we're giving you a free channel of art and information. And that's why it's so important that everybody just tune into Art Attack, because our love for art is infectious. And I think that's why we're building such a big audience.
And I'm glad that you are. I really am, because it is a show for someone like myself who would like to know more. But in some places, you know, you really just don't want to walk up to Thurston and ask him about that painting.
Exactly.
<you know?
laughs> Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, we can go highbrow, but we can go lowbrow. But the reality is we're really telling the story and making it interesting so that you can go off and do your own discovery. And it's also entertainment. You know, at the end of the day, when especially when we don't agree, you know, a lot of people just love the banter. But I think it's the passion that people really, really enjoy, and it infects them. I can't even tell you how many emails we've got from around the world, people that really just love the show.
And I have to tell you, I did, in preparation for this interview, look over a lot of your art. And, you know, I didn't know there's so many things that you have painted that I have seen over a period of my life that I had no idea where it came from. Congratulations again on your 100th episode of Art Attack, which is coming up. And I'd like to ask you, what does that mean for the both of you?
That means that we're just going to do 100 more and 100 more and 100 more.
All
I mean,
right.
I swear to God.
All
this is going
right.
to keep going and keep growing. That's the motto. If you tune into my Instagram, JustinBUA, you'll be able to see all the stuff that's going on there. It's all happening.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Justin Bua. Again, that 100th episode coming up, that'll be at artattackpodcast.com. You can also listen and catch up on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Instagram, Justin Bua, and justinbua.com. That's justinbua.com. As KVC Arts continues, a new interview with someone who was on the first KVC Arts, formerly of and occasionally with the Stray Cats, Lee Rocker, with a new album just out. I'd interviewed Lee Rocker from the Stray Cats not long after his most recent album, and that became a portion of the first KVC Arts. Now, as we hit show number 295, once again, he's just released a new album and will be in the area soon. The new album is called The Low Road, a recording from one rather special night on tour. Absolutely, it completely feels like it. And now that I know that it's live, because not all of the tracks start off with any applause or ambience from the crowd or whatever, but you do get it fading out at the end, so it's slow to catch on to that. So this explains then some of the tunes that you cover on other discs of yours or even the Stray Cats. I guess the one I want to go into, we've covered some of your stuff in the past, like That's All Right Mama, coupled with Blue Moon of Kentucky. I always love that one, no matter which version I hear from you doing it. So it wasn't really a question of redoing it. This was just a live performance, but still you chose to include it.
Exactly, this was capturing what we were doing, just a really magical way.
Well, another really cool one that caught my attention, and that is Good Rockin' Tonight. A Roy Brown original, but with this song, there's so many versions of this over the years. Robert Plant and the Honey Drippers for folks our age. What was the one that you latched onto? With your record collecting days, would it have been the Sun Records Elvis take for that?
Yeah, that's probably where I first came into it. But, you know, one of the amazing things about this form of music is it's sort of part of the vocabulary amongst musicians, and everyone, you know, when you're doing this kind of stuff, everyone puts their own take on it. So I came at it probably originally hearing it on Sun Sessions from Presley, but so many versions. And then this music is, in my mind, what I do with my Lee Rocker stuff or Stray Cats or really anything I'm involved with. It's a musical conversation. Nothing is really written in stone. And it's all interactive and reactive from the musicians playing together. When you hear something, you kind of turn a phrase a different way, a drum fill, a guitar riff, a bass figure, and everyone at its best, it should be a very fluid kind of thing that never comes out the same way twice.
Nice. That leads me to ask, in this world of music, so much of what a person may do will certainly be covers, and in a way I should say that they better be, as long as they're getting away from the far too oft-covered tunes, but staying within the canon, as it were. So when you're doing these things, it's not so much of trying to put your own stamp on it, but you're just really feeling it out? It just happens that way?
Yeah, for a big degree, yes. You know, I mean, certainly some things are tempos and things, maybe, but so much of it is reactive, and I think that's really how it needs to be done. You know, in a funny way, I've always been involved in a rock and roll band with sort of almost more of a jazz mentality in that way.
Nice. As a kid, it was rock and roll, but then later in my world of NPR and public radio, it was a lot of jazz, so it's really cool to hear somebody who's playing primarily a three-chord rock kind of thing to think in this world of improvisation or shifting spaces.
And that, I think, is really key, and it just brings that excitement, that energy. It's not rote. And really everything I've done over the years has been from that kind of philosophy and that kind of direction.
Well,
slight sidebar, you were trained on the cello as a child up until maybe, what, 13 or 14 or so?
Right.
Yep, did you leave that completely behind?
It's in there somewhere. I grew up in a musical family.
Yeah.
My parents are both classical musicians. My dad was at the New York Philharmonic solo clarinet for 16 years, and my mom was a music professor at Hofstra University out in New York. You know, growing up, that was the one rule. You played an instrument starting very young. And I picked the cello and did that from around 7 to about 13. Took lessons, read music. You know, over the years, did quite a bit of harmony and arranging and sight singing and a lot of different lessons and classes that I think, you know, in a certain sense, after enough years, you just digest them and it's part of the overall, you know, without even really thinking about it. But I certainly had a musical education.
Oh, yeah. Your sister as well. I know that she is a singer-songwriter at one point based out of Nashville. And I know that she's ended up doing some background vocals on your work. Have you ended up on any of her stuff anywhere by chance?
Yes, Roseanne Drucker. She's got a CD and tracks out. And I did play bass on a couple of things for her. Hmm. Now it's been quite a few years ago.
Going back to the Stray Cats, I just read, and this just cracked me up, that when you guys were performing in the early days, you were, oh, the Tomcats or the Teds or Brian the Tomcats and all that. And this is according to Brian Setzer, that is, the band changed names to fool club owners who would not hire the same band for consecutive nights. Really?
You know, I don't
okay.
I don't actually know, but we definitely, in the very early days, we did have a couple of different names. From my recollection, it was because we really couldn't settle on one. But it could be, you know, the name Stray Cats, really, I named the band that, and it stuck after we got to England. So we started in New York in the late 70s doing CBGBs in Max's Kansas City, and then a lot of, like, corner bar places around Long Island, you know, just, you know, places, you know, no stage or anything, just setting up and playing some music. And we didn't really have a set name till England. We were always a cat, something cat for the most part. And then it just seemed appropriate after we all left home that it was Stray Cats, and that's the one that got traction.
And that came from the movie poster in Dave Edmonds.
No, actually, I came up with the name and pitched it to the guys completely unaware of the music poster. And the funny thing is, our first record producer is a gentleman, Dave Edmonds.
Yeah.
amazing producer and musician. So we had the name, we got the record deal, and we go to Dave's house. We're talking to different producers and talk to him about working with him, vice versa. And on his wall was a poster that said Stray Cats. We're like, man, we had no idea. It felt like it was meant to be then.
I'm so glad that we were speaking about this, because even after our last conversation, I took it that it was the other way around. You were trying to figure out the name until you saw the poster.
No, no.
It's too cool.
And we couldn't believe it. There it was on a poster.
Yeah.
Got cat style.
David Fleming in conversation with Lee Rocker, with new album just out and with an appearance at the Lewis Family Playhouse in Rancho Cucamonga soon. More at lewisfamilyplayhouse.com and more on Lee Rocker at leerocker.com. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR, online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. Well, speaking of the Stray Cats, but back to the Low Road, Rumble in Brighton. Oh my God, yes. I was so excited to see that this one. And I may possibly like this one better, but that's a relative statement.
Well, there's the rock billy cats with the tops real high, wearing black drape coats, all real gone guys. Cool skinny heads with the roll up jeans, looking real tough, mighty mean. There's a rumbling bright tonight. Ringside seats for the neighborhood fight. Ain't a damn thing that the cops can do. Rumbling bright tonight.
So here's the question with something like this. When you put a song from the Stray Cats on an album of yours, do Slim Jim and Brian get a cut? You know, how does this work when it's a portion of a band independently covering some of the music from that band?
Yeah, it just depends on the arrangement the band has and writers, shares, and things like that. But I'm always happy to do it, you know, and especially with the live record, you know, that music is such a part of all of us and a part of me that I have to do something. I've got to do that. I've got to do Rock This Town. There's certain songs that I just don't walk out on the stage and not play.
No, certainly. Let's see here. I think this was not the same album with Rumblin' Brighton, but in 1982, we ended up with Built for Speed. This is going back and forth, obviously. We're going back to the Stray Cats here. But this was a side note. I understand it was essentially a compilation of 12 songs taken from the UK releases, and then 6 from Stray Cats, and then 5 from Gonna Ball. The question is, of any of those ones that were on the UK releases that did not make it to Built for Speed, what do you really feel should have gotten more attention from there? You know, it just didn't make the cut, though.
You know, it was actually a tough call. There certainly were tracks. It was just really trying to put together the best of, really. And we definitely had record company input and how they wanted to sort of present the band in a way. And the one new song, which was the title track, which, you know, is Built for Speed.
Yeah.
But let me think. Here's a few things that did not make it.
I know I'm going 37 years back, so...
Yeah, I'm just actually looking at something. I'm not positive, but we're definitely going to ball. Luckily now, pretty much everything has been re-released in a lot of different forms. And actually, a box set has just come out this year of the Stray Cats that deals with the first 3 records on vinyl, really beautifully done, and an album of rarities. So it's very cool that we've really gotten a lot of the B-sides and things re-released, which definitely is cool.
Oh, so many of the times the B-side or that third song on side 2 of the album, you know, those are the ones that sometimes are the best tunes, but they don't make it purely because of proximity. You do have a beautiful ballad on the Low Road, and that is I Won't Stand in Your Way. So stopping with that jump swing rockabilly for just a bit, Where does this fall on the disc? You mentioned that it's an album, so it's fair to ask, is this the type of thing to wrap side one or closing it out? The digital age, folks have gotten away from making sure there's a linear flow, so really want to know where the ballad falls for you.
Right. I actually have the ballad on this as the third song on the vinyl, the A-side as the third song. So happy with it. Song that we did with the Stray Cats. I've done a real rework on this in a way, change of keys and brought it down a couple of steps and reworked it really to take advantage of my band and everyone's abilities. So that's a track I'm super happy with. It's a little bit doo-wop-ish and it's a little kind of slinky 50s song.
Yeah.
If it's so, then it's round. We've held on so long. I won't.
You'd mentioned, you know, taking advantage of the band that you have, Ophelia. There's a nice prominence of the piano. So where did this one come from for you?
I'll tell you, every song I do, I've got such a personal connection with, and that's really what I want to emphasize in a way. Same thing with my live concerts. What I do, and I know I'm going to be up in your neck of the woods out in Rancho Cucamonga shortly, is all of these songs have such a closeness to me. And Ophelia is a song that I got a call a few years ago, five or six, maybe a little more, from Levon Helm. And Levon was the singer for the band.
Yeah.
Such great music up on Cripple Creek and the night they drove Old Dixie down. Such great American music.
The Weights.
And towards the end of his life, he couldn't tour, but he sure as hell was making beautiful music. So he started to do a thing in his barn every Saturday night called the Midnight Ramble. And Levon called, said, hey, you want to ramble? And I said, absolutely. And went up to Woodstock and performed with him, and this is one of the songs. And Levon is just a giant of American music, singer, drummer, mandolin player. He's passed now. And he started as a rockabilly drummer, so we truly understood each other. And that's the reason why I've been doing that song, and I've been playing this just about every night on stage. And my live concert, I get to talk about these things. I was saying we're going to be up in Rancho Cucamonga. Part of what I do now, which I'm loving over these years, is on tour we've got a screen and some film as well as some still photos, and it gives me a chance to do the concert, of course, but to tell some stories and talk about behind the music and why I'm doing certain songs and how or why I wrote things a certain way or what they mean, and as well as tell some funny stuff that's happened over these past 40 years on tour.
Wow.
Ashes of laughter. The ghost is clear. Riding on the city of New Orleans, Illinois Central, Monday morning mail.
But, speaking of which, the films showing in the background and all that, that makes me want to ask about City of New Orleans. A song that, it's just a beautiful song, a beautiful story, whether it's Steve Goodman or Arlo Guthrie or your take on it. And it was really beautiful take on the cover sessions. This is, by the way, a disc I've had now, I guess, for 6 years or so, and it's still pulled out every month or so just to go through it again. So you covered it, but this is, of course, another recording of it, this one with the video. But it's not presented as much of a performance when you're watching this video. There's some superimposing going on with you guys there against the wood walls, and I guess this is Daryl's place. But then we've got these things like, I'm Your Native Son. We get a brief glimpse of Elvis at this point. And all these little bits of Americana. Is this all your son's doing, Justin?
Yes. He is the filmmaker that has been doing a lot of things with me and for me on these concerts, which are mainly performing arts centers. And he did do that film, which I love. And that's, as you said, it's such a great piece of American music. And for me, I was telling you about Ophelia and how I came to that. For me, City of New Orleans was, I had done a number of things over the years with Willie Nelson, and I loved Willie's version also. This goes back quite a while, and it's one of the songs I used to sing to my kids just at the house, like putting them to sleep when they were babies. So I've had this song sort of with me for so many years. It's one I just feels it's really transforming in a way.
It's one of those songs that, you know, what is it like, you know, 3 minutes, 18 seconds or something like that. But it's one of those songs that takes you into a story. You feel like you've been reading a story of America and deeply immersed in it. And then this train's got to disappear in the railroad news. Oh, my gosh. You've only been there for 3 minutes, but you're suddenly having the life taken out of you there.
Yes, absolutely. And I was very happy. I did get a message from Steve Goodman's son. A while back, and you know, said his dad would have loved the version, so that was very, very nice to hear.
Yes, incredible. That had to have just blown you away. You don't expect calls like that. Wow.
No.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Back now to Lee Rocker. Now, with and without the Stray Cats, he's been producing and performing in the rockabilly world for the last 40 years, and he'll be at the Lewis Family Playhouse soon, and has a new album out, The Low Road.
I said, my sweet baby wears fishnet stockings, which starts rocking me in the anal stuff. In a fishnet stockings. Got a pair in pink, got a pair in red. Would you put some black ones on that toe?
One of the things I'm loving with this band that I've got now is the versatility, that we really can change gears a little bit and have a lot of dimensions to it.
This takes us back to The Low Road with Fishnet Stockings. This is, again, a tune that I wasn't aware of previous to hearing your take on it. An upbeat, almost a boogie-woogie, teetering on that, swinging tune again.
This is one of the very early Stray Cat songs. Always loved doing that one. And that one, at this point, makes an occasional appearance. It's not an every-nighter for me, but sometimes it just feels right, and that's one of those audibles, kind of, I'll just call it on stage, go, let's do it, guys, you know?
Okay, well, I had the early albums, you know, in 82, 3, you know, whenever that was, when the Stray Cats were just all over the scene. I had those albums, I just missed that.
It's on the first English record.
Okay. Yep. The songs that ended up on The Low Road, and of course this is just, you were taking selections from this concert performance. Any songs that had been on the shelf waiting for time for a new album, and this performance ended up being the vehicle for it?
Well, I would say that to me is probably Ophelia, that I haven't done on any record, and just the feeling I have doing that song after getting to work with Levon. And that to me really is a high point. And as we were just talking about, something that does sort of bend things a little bit away, really, from what a lot of people think of me as being exclusively rockabilly. It's a different kind of feeling track with the piano. The drums are almost a New Orleans kind of second line kind of feel.
Listening to it, you're just waiting for the folks to come along with the umbrellas. And that portion of the funnest funeral a person might ever go to. Yeah.
Got a pair of pink, got a pair of red. Would you put
another, I hate to say cover because it just sounds like you're, you know, a tribute band, but I'll Cry Instead. Again, excited to see this one. This is the Beatles tune from A Hard Day's Night. Tempo, I'd say it's not much faster, but it feels like it's faster with the bass slapping propulsion kind of going on. You're sort of taking a double time but keeping the same meter.
Definitely, and that's just a fun track, you know, with harmonicas blaring and just a hell of a fun track to do anyway, but I love that song live. And that, you know, goes back to, as I've been saying, you know, the reason for doing songs is that I played that song and spent a nice amount of time with George Harrison years ago, as well as Ringo, and played on Ringo's Vertical Man record. And, you know, really got to sit and talk and hang out a little bit and talk about those early Beatle records being so close to rockabilly. The English skiffle sound, as they call it, really, it's rockabilly. And, you know, always stuck with me and thought about that. George Harrison, we did a thing together with Carl Perkins back in the 80s, and George told me that he used to check into hotels under the name Carl Perkins.
There's some disappointed. And some people knew Carl's name, so that would have been just a riot for his door.
Oh, yeah.
To be... Wow. Okay, this goes back to something relative there. On our previous interview, we spoke just briefly. It was almost an aside that you performed on a Scotty Moore record in the past. And Scotty Moore, this is Elvis's guitarist. What was this album, if folks want to track it down? What was your involvement?
It's a very cool record, and I think it may be one that needs to be tracked down for any real American music fan. It's called All the King's Men.
Mm-hmm.
We did it out in Tennessee, and there was a great selection of musicians on it. Levon Helm did a track with him. Keith Richards is on it. I'm on it. Steve Earle.
Oh, wow.
And a number of other people. And actually, I'm so glad you're bringing it up, because I'm going to go pull this record out myself later today to give it a listen. And that was All the King's Men, and it was Scotty Moore and DJ Fontana. And then friends of theirs and fans of theirs, we all gathered, and it's a super cool record. I believe it's the last record that Scotty Moore ever made.
Oh, gosh. Wow. That's definitely one that I need to track down. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Lee Rocker, with the new album just out, and with an appearance at the Lewis Family Playhouse in Rancho Cucamonga soon. More at lewisfamilyplayhouse.com, and more on Lee Rocker at leerocker.com. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR, online and mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. Another bit about the last time we spoke. You mentioned having cameras all over the place in your studio, and with that, you would have some quick videos released. I mean, quotes around the videos. It was just a quick live performance, and suddenly it was available. Are you still doing this?
I haven't done this in quite a while, and things have changed so much since then, where now everyone's got the ability to just kind of turn on the phone and do that. So, you know, it's sort of evolved more into every once in a while just like shooting sound checks and things and putting that out, but not in a commercial way, just in a, hey, let's share this and put it up on social media and websites.
Gotcha. It would be the bonus disc on a DVD. Okay. Going back to the cover sessions, when I was revisiting our previous interview, I realized that of the only six tracks that ended up on the cover sessions, it seems like you mentioned that there were maybe 12 or so that you had chosen, and you whittled it down to these. The other six, are these like the missing years? Are they out there somewhere? Did you record them?
Recorded them and
tossed.
They didn't go where I wanted them to. So they're probably half-baked, is how I would describe it. Although I have to say, the cover sessions to me is one of the favorite things that I've done really throughout my career. And at this point now, when it first came out, two other songs were added to it online. So there are eight now. And it's kind of a project that I've always in the back of my mind think I need to go back and add to and cut some more of these tracks and do them my way with a lot of acoustic instruments, you know, acoustic guitar and mandolin and banjo and accordions, and really the concept for it was really to be very minimal on drums and for the most part just using hand percussion and acoustic instruments.
And weren't most of those instruments played by you, just a lot of layering, and these were just instruments you collected?
Yes, it was really almost entirely me and then Buzz Campbell, so between the two of us. It was a heck of a lot of work, and there's a lot of satisfaction in that.
Absolutely. I remember you discussing that it was, in essence, playing back the AM radio days of your childhood.
Just exactly. The songs that I grew up listening to late at night, taking the transistor radio, putting it under your head and listening to it so the rest of the family didn't hear it, you know?
Yep. That's a really nice way to wrap with this, in that so much of the music that you play, whether or not we realize it, it has come from some part of our childhood. We may hear a song, but because of the way you're doing it, it may not click in until the third chorus. That,
right.
Oh my God, that's something from Mom's At the Hop Records or something like that. And so
Right. You're
keeping all kinds of musics alive. I put that plural on purpose because the American music canon is so diverse by this point, and you cover so much of it, and it's just greatly appreciated. It's been 7 years since the last disc, so very, very excited for this one. One other thing on that one, why the decision to do not only CD, but also vinyl?
I love vinyl, and I couldn't be happier that the Low Road is on green, transparent vinyl, so it sounds even better on green. But I love the physical record. It's something that I kind of miss over the years, and I'm just so happy that it's really made a resurgence. I mean, not just with what I'm doing with Low Road. We've done this with the Stray Cats 40 album this year, and I'm just determined, and many people are going back to vinyl. It's just a great medium. It sounds, sonically, I think it's the best still, and it forces everyone into listening in the sequence that the artist wants to hear the music in. And I think it also, you know, because it is vinyl, it makes everyone have to have an attention span of 16, 17, 18 minutes, which is a good thing.
Yes, it is something lost, and I'm so glad that folks are bringing it back, including yourself as well. Really, a big, big thanks again for not only being a part of my first show, which you weren't even aware of, but it's going to be like 291 or two or so like that, so it's
okay,
great to have you back.
Well, I hope I'm back again before we're at, what would that make it, about 580.
Yes, indeed. We'll make sure it happens again.
Come together right now over me.
I've been speaking with Lee Rocker, a new album out and in the area soon. He'll be at the Lewis Family Playhouse in Rancho Cucamonga. More at lewisfamilyplayhouse.com and more on Lee Rocker at leerocker.com. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Lee Rocker and to Justin Bua. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Shireen Awad, and Emmanuel Rogers. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, and NPR One. And all past shows are kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.